Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. St. Valentine's Day coming up. St. Valentine's Day coming up. how many of you are going to be buying Valentines for various people? I assume almost everybody listening to me is going to be buying at least one Valentine. And I'm not really sure who St. Valentine, not being Catholic, I don't know if it makes any difference anymore because they reduce the number of saints. Cause of, maybe, I don't know, was it budget crunch in the Catholic Church or something? They had to lay off a whole bunch of saints. And one of them maybe was St. Valentine. I know they don't de-sanctify anybody, do they? Well, maybe they do. No, they don't do that. They don't de-sanctify anybody. It's almost like a computer that runs out of memory. It automatically, if it has a back, if you have a backup on your computer, it automatically will get rid of the oldest stuff and put the newest stuff in. So I don't know. But St. Valentine's, I don't know exactly who he was, although I believe, I'm not really sure. Is he the one that got filled full of arrows by Roman soldiers? I don't know. or is that Cupid? I'm getting confused with Cupid. Cupid is the one that launches an arrow. I'm sorry. Launches an arrow at somebody's heart. The idea of an arrow sticking through somebody's heart... It seems very old-fashioned Catholic to me. All you would need is, I mean, is there a difference between sticking a saint full of arrows and blood running down and him, you know, in the cause of Jesus and Cupid? Who is Cupid anyhow? Cupid always gave me the creeps. Cupid gave you the creeps, this little round, chubby, I'm not sure. Cupid has something. Cupid is the... I don't know, the son of Venus? Maybe, I don't know. But Cupid shoots arrows at people, and then they see each other and they fall in love. Anyhow, I bought a Valentine's Day card for my wife, and may yet buy one for my son and daughter, although probably a phone call will do it. And, of course, a Valentine's Day card is really a symbol. It's just a symbol of love. It's not actually love, is it? But love, as are many other things, is represented by or are represented by symbols in this world. And love can sometimes get confused. I mean, love should be a simple thing. But, of course, everybody knows the older you get, the more you understand that it's not. When you're a kid, it seems simple. You know, if you have a good experience, you look at, even if you don't, when you're a little baby or when you're a kid, you look up at your parents and you love them. You love them. And they seem, if they actually do, they seem to love you. They seem to love you. Now, if you're lucky, go off in different tangents here today. I got a couple of critiques recently from people who said that listening to me in the last month or two, or maybe longer, was they felt like they were my therapist and I was just spewing out therapy talk, that I was the analysand and then they were the analyst and they were listening to this dredging up of my childhood and talking about how upset I am. You know, I apologize if that's what's been happening. Usually I try to take a universal topic. This has been my lifelong on the radio practice, to take a universal topic and illustrate it sometimes by my own personal life. And but I've been getting a lot of, not a lot, I've gotten a few critiques from people. I should say a handful. To me, a little bit of something bad is a lot. And that was one of the critiques, that I'm negative. Well, that's true. My default position is negative. And one thing I try to do in my life, and it's an uphill battle, but since I am kind of essentially a negative person for various reasons, I try to, and this radio show has always been part of that, I try to tell stories or discuss subjects or find out universal themes that wind up somehow at the end being more positive for me and for the people who are listening. And I would love to feel, although I know sometimes it's hit and miss, that the topics I pick are universal topics because, like in the case of love, which we're going to talk about today, love and money, it's the most complex thing in the world. It is the most complex thing in the world. There's no supercomputer that is anywhere near a billionth as complex as the idea of a simply loving somebody else or trying to love somebody else or being in love or understanding what love is. And but to a lot of people, money turns out to be love. And sometimes it's, like I say, it's complicated. People love other people, but they're not able to express their love. And if they have a lot of money or if they make a lot of money, and usually this happens with men, it used to be with generations like this. Although these days, I don't know, with women working a lot and making a lot of money or a lot more money than they used to and being professionals a lot more than they used to, maybe it applies to women now too. But in my generation, which was, you know, 50s, 60s, even 70s, you know, it was always men. We grew up with the men working and the women home. And the women, the mothers, and this is all, again, predicated on the idea that you had something approximating a normal family. Now, not everybody did. Like, for instance, I didn't. But a lot of people I knew did. Most people in my neighborhood did, had what I would call a normal family, although, of course, people say there is no such thing as a normal family. And there are undercurrents and complexities and flaws in even the most seemingly, wonderful family. So, but in my neighborhood, lower middle class neighborhood out in Queens in New York, it was, it was a house, was a father and the mother and at least two children, sometimes maybe three children. These weren't very big houses. And people weren't into having big families, although a lot of them came from cultures, Italians and the Jews, where maybe 30, 40 years before that, you know, around 1910, 20, 30, having big families was the standard, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 children. But the mother was the one who was home all the time and taking care of the house and cooking and watching the kids, taking care of the kids, making breakfast for them, making sure that they were in school on time. And the father went off sometimes very early in the morning to go to work. And the father, you didn't see as much as you saw the mother. You only saw the father at night. The mother was always there. When you got home from school, the mother was there. So the mother's presence itself, assuming that the mother, you know, that your mother loved you and the mother loved your children, the presence of the mother was an expression of love. Whatever other expressions of love, and then food that she prepared, like the lunchbox that she put a specially prepared sandwich in, the breakfast that she made for you, the dinner that she cooked, the fact that she washed your clothes, and you see, this is the, my generation, and that she cleaned the house and that she checked and see if you were doing your homework, although you might not like that. All of this was an expression of love. The father worked in the hard, hard world out in the world. And these guys didn't make a lot of money. I'm talking about lower middle class here. But they came home and they were tired. But that was their job. So you didn't see them as much. And you got to see them more rarely. But a lot of times in some families, since the father wasn't around so much, in some cases the fathers weren't around at all. In middle class, upper middle class, and upper class families, sometimes fathers who were professionals or business people, or in some cases who were celebrities or international celebrities or worked at a very high level, would be traveling all the time and they hardly ever saw them. And so their presence, their actual presence, love was not expressed by them being around all the time, unless, of course, they came home at the same time every night and then they, you know, spent a lot of time with their kids. What am I getting at here? Recently, there have been some very famous cases talked about in the newspapers having to do with families who are fighting over the money, over the estates, sometimes involving tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of dollars of celebrities and famous people that died. And there was an article that came out in the New York Times the other day, which I found very interesting. It's about Marina Picasso, who is the grandchild of Pablo Picasso, of course. And this is the article. I'll read you some of it here. Since Marina Picasso was a child living on the edge of poverty and lingering at the gates of a French villa with her father to plead for an allowance from her grandfather, Pablo Picasso, she has struggled with the burden of that artist's towering legacy. When she was in her 20s and inherited the 19th century villa, La Californie, as well as a vast trove of Picasso's art treasures, she turned the paintings to face the walls in resentment. Although through 15 years of therapy, she dissected bitter family memories of her grandfather's perceived indifference and her brother's suicide. In her 2001 memoir, Picasso, My Grandfather, she bared her pain and anger at the Picasso clan. Now 64, Ms. Picasso acknowledges that she is expanding her rebellion still, right, by preparing to sell off many of his artworks to finance and broaden her philanthropy, aid for a pediatric hospital in Vietnam and projects in France and Switzerland benefiting the elderly and troubled teenagers. And her unconventional sales approach is reverberating through the international art market. She's dumping a lot of this art, and it's worrying dealers, of course. Because she's going to, it's like all of a sudden there's too much gold or too much oil on the market, it depresses the prices. So that, that's upsetting if you're an art dealer or if you own a Picasso as an investment. But I got rid of all my Picassos years ago. You know, I'm not trapped in that kind of problem. I sold them all off. Anyhow, Miss Picasso has been regularly selling her grandfather's works for years to support herself and her charities. She was left 10,000 Picasso works. This is from somebody who once treated her, as far as she's concerned, and maybe so, extremely cruelly and indifferent. And she lived in poverty and her family lived in misery, and she blamed it all on her grandfather. Even her parents' lives were made miserable. She felt she saw for her by her grandfather's cruelty and indifference. And Picasso, I don't really know much about the man's life, but what I do know from reading articles and having read some books once upon a time is that he was considered to be notoriously narcissistic and sometimes cruel and indifferent towards the people who loved him or towards the people in his family. As it says here, Miss Picasso has been regularly selling her grandfather's works for years to support herself and her charities. And since the death of her long-term dealer in 2008, she has tried various strategies in the market, auctioning off major paintings and displaying them on her own to people and selling them to private collectors, which is not the way apparently you do it. You have to work through a dealer. But her decision to sell them on her own suggests a more aggressive effort to purge herself of her legacy, to purge herself of her legacy. It's better for me to sell my works, she said, and preserve the money to redistribute to humanitarian causes. She was speaking publicly about her new strategy for the first time while inspecting a hospital site in Marseille, where she is financing a psychiatric unit for teenagers in crisis. I have paintings, of course, and I can use this to support these projects. The 10,000 artworks she inherited were not just paintings. There were something like 300 paintings. The rest were ceramics and sculpture. And I'm going to skip through this because some of it is all just about the art market. Ms. Picasso, who inherited about 300 paintings among the 10,000 Picasso artworks, ceramics, drawings, etchings, etc., and sculptures, said she decided on the number. She has not decided on the number to be sold and had no plan to put the villa on the market. But she knows which piece she will sell first, La Famille, a 1935 portrait of a family surrounded by an arid landscape. It's symbolic because I was born in a great family, but it was a family that was not a family, Ms. Picasso said. And skipping ahead here, while the sales will broaden Ms. Picasso's philanthropy, they will also help her move on from the burden of her family history, she said. Ms. Picasso said that she had no photographs of herself with her grandfather and had none of his works until she received her inheritance. She recalled that he would fashion flowers out of paper for her, but she was never allowed to keep the trinkets. Her father, Paolo, was the son of Picasso and his first wife, Olga Kolklova, a Russian ballerina. Ms. Picasso said she still suffered from the memories of Paolo, her father, serving as her grandfather's chauffeur, among other lowly roles, and begging for money. And her mother, Emilienne, split from her father and struggled with alcoholism. She relied on handouts from her ex-husband to raise Marina, that's the woman we're talking about here, and her older brother, Pablito. I saw my father very little, Ms. Picasso said. I didn't have a grandfather. Her alienation from her grandfather and his entourage intensified after her brother was barred from Picasso's funeral in 1973 by the artist's second wife, Jacqueline Roque. A few days later, her brother committed suicide by drinking bleach. Oh, man. Contributions from friends paid for Pablito's funeral, according to Ms. Picasso, who supported herself then by working in a hospice for autistic and mentally ill children. Picasso left no will when he died at 91, setting off a bitter struggle among his widow, children, and grandchildren. Unexpectedly, Marina Picasso was named an heir, inheriting a fifth of the estate, including the villa. People say I should appreciate my inheritance, and I do, Ms. Picasso said, but it is an inheritance without love, an inheritance without love. In the end, she learned from her past. It was really difficult to carry this celebrated name and to have a difficult financial life, she said. I think because of it, I developed my sense of humanity and desire to help others. Ms. Picasso, who has five children, three of them adopted from Vietnam, said that selling more of Picasso's art to expand her charities is a fitting use. And she said, I now live in the present. The past rests in the past. But I will never forget, never. Well, sounds contradictory. I respect my grandfather and his stature as an artist. I was his grandchild and his heir, but never the grandchild of his heart. Money. Money. And now we see Robin Williams' children are suing Robin Williams' wife or widow right now for objects in the house that belong, they say, to their father that mean more to him, more to them than it does to their mother. And James Brown estate is being contested. It's like $100 million, and I think it involves various women or wives and children, Martin Luther King's children, of all people, Martin Luther King, the man of peace and bringing people together, they're suing each other. So there's always a lot of fighting. I shouldn't say always. There's often fighting over money. Now, these are high-profile cases. These are high-profile cases. But this has happened many, many times over thousands of years, you know, and families, and maybe this strikes a chord in you. Now, it could be that you come from a family where this is not an issue at all, where maybe there was really nothing to inherit at all. Somebody was absolutely poverty-stricken and never really had much money or any objects of value. Maybe you came from a family where there was a lot of money that the usually, in this case, it turns out usually to be the father, but this is a generational thing, where there was a lot of money and a lot of treasured objects, or even if it was just a middle-class life that you lead, there was, you know, some insurance money, there was, you know, money in a bank account, maybe a house was left, and an estate. And then there were cherished objects, like a special cereal bowl that your father used and, you know, you thought of him when you saw it, or a pipe that he smoked, or, you know, his golf clubs that he used all the time, or a special sweater vest that he loved to wear, and his slippers. Things like this become like cherished objects, like cherished memories of things. And they represent the person. They represent the person. Now, if this person, when they were alive, let's say if this man or this woman, your mother or your father, when they were alive, if they gave you and they gave the various siblings all the love that they could, and they were loving parents, loving mothers and loving fathers, I think very often there isn't really an argument. Sometimes there'll be a little bit of a disagreement, or maybe people will, differ on certain things. But there won't be this out-and-out, sometimes warfare that goes on between lawsuits, people, fighting with each other, not speaking to each other. Sometimes violence goes on. This kind of thing can happen. I think what happens is that it occurs when the person that you're talking about, the person that died, who left the estate, didn't really give themselves as an example of love. Their presence, their love wasn't shared, wasn't given personally. So often what men used to do, and my father did this in spades, was he was never around, and men weren't around that much. They would give presents in place of themselves. Now, especially men who traveled, or men who weren't at home very much, and like my father. When he came back from a trip, for instance, he would bring an interesting – he would travel all over the world, and he was hardly ever around at all. I hardly ever saw him. But he would come back, and he'd give me a present. And then, you know, he was off again. So – but the present was supposed to show me how much the object was supposed to show me how much he loved me. And I still have some of these things. I have an old carved wooden dagger. It's an actual steel dagger, but it's a wooden scabbard, I should say, that's decorated, that he brought me when I was about 12 years old because he had traveled to India. And I have a watch, an old watch, although it's like about 150 years old, that he bought me from, that he gave me. Actually, he left it to me in his estate. Very few things and objects that he left, but he gave me this watch posthumously. A friend of his came and gave it to me after he died. It's a silver pocket watch, an old-fashioned pocket watch with a chain that you wind with a key. So I have a few things. I have some business cards that belong to him. But he used to come back from these long trips and give me presents. But these lawsuits and these fights and things that go on in families where people bicker with each other and sometimes don't talk to each other for a long time or for years on end. And you can see this happening in the high-profile cases in the news. It's not the money or the objects, really. It's the love and the loss. It's the love they're battling for. And the more money, you know, the less love there was, then the more money. If the man, you know, made a lot of money, if he had a lot of money, if your father had a lot of objects or art objects or like in Picasso's case, if he left all these things and they were worth a lot of money or he left a lot of money, it stands in for the love. And if you didn't get the love that you felt you needed, and if you actually, you know, really didn't get it, sometimes maybe you got it, but you didn't see it or you didn't understand it, because love is complex. But sometimes it turns out that it's when somebody didn't give you that much love, the more money that you get from them, the more you feel like you're loved, which, of course, is false. Because you can't, you know that old phrase, you can't take it with you? You know, you can't take it with you. You can't take money or material things with you. Also, if you're alive and somebody dies, you can't create it or replace it with money. You can't create or replace love with money. You can't duplicate it with money. On the other hand, as Jimmy Stewart says in It's a Wonderful Life, when talking to an angel, the angel says to him, we don't use any money up in heaven. He says, oh, really? It comes in pretty handy down here, bub. You know, I mean, after all, money that's left to you by a parent can actually be left in love. It can be left by a loving parent as an example of love, and because they want to provide for you. Let's say they have a lot of money and they want to make your life easier. And of course, we all need money. We all need money. But it can't replace the love you didn't have. It cannot replace the love you didn't have. And in my own case, with my father, it was a complicated thing because he didn't really, express whatever love he might have felt. And I'm sure he loved me in his own way, as hard as it was for him to love anybody. And speaking of which, I'm no paragon either. You know, I just bought a Valentine's Day card, like I said earlier, for my wife. But my love for other people is complex. I have trouble accepting it. And as I said, I use myself as an example here. And I might be an extreme example. So I have trouble accepting it, and I have trouble giving it. Love is something that I always feel like I desperately want. But sometimes when I get it, it doesn't penetrate like Cupid's arrow. It just bounces off like I had armor on. So, but on the other hand, the money can't replace love. But in some ways, you know, sometimes you really need the money. And you think to yourself, well, it's thoughtful. You know, the guy died and he wasn't, let's say, around all that much. Or maybe he was. And the money is something I can really use. But money cannot. What do we got, about like a half an hour? Yeah. So the money cannot replace love. But on the other hand, money can come in very handy.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money. Such a thrill, but your love won't pay my bills. I want money. That's what I want. That's what I want. That's what I want. money don't get everything, it's true. What it don't get, I can't use. I want money.
Indeed. Indeed. Speaking of my father and money and love and objects, just a few days ago, it was 40 years since my father died. He died in January, at the end of January 1975, so it's been 40 years. And died in a plane crash in Istanbul, actually off Istanbul in the waters of the Black Sea, and disappeared, including the plane and everybody on it, never to be seen again. So he died, I hope, instantly. The plane plunged into the water. And my sister and I, and then it's my father dying in such a typical way. My father was always flying off to someplace in the world. And one of the problems I had in terms of guilt and a kind of almost psychotic grandiosity was that one time my father, when I was a kid, he had a habit. He was never around. He left when I was four. But when I was a kid, he used to have a habit of buying insurance. You could buy insurance at the airport back in the 50s. And one time when I was 9 years old, he was off on one of his trips, and I don't know where he was going. I mean, he was gone anyhow from the house, and then he would just leave to go away for months and months and months sometimes. Like, sometimes he was away for a year. But when he'd fly away on these business trips, on these engineering trips, he was a chemical engineer, and he was also a construction engineer. He would buy insurance at the airport. One time when I was 9 years old, I got very few letters from my father, most of which I kept and treasured for a long time. I'm not sure if I have too many of them left, maybe a couple. And a couple of pictures of him taken in foreign, exotic places. But I opened this letter up when I was 9 years old from my father, and it was from LaGuardia. No, it was from Kennedy Airport. It wasn't called Kennedy then. It was called Idlewild Airport. It was in 1954. And I opened the envelope up and I said, whoa, a letter from my father. Anything that came from my father, since I hardly ever saw the guy, was a really big thing for me. So even the envelope and the letter itself, whatever even it said, even the envelope itself, even the stamp, I used to hold on forever because these were symbols of my father. This is all I got of my father, right? This was his love, even just an envelope from him, even a letter from him. Since he himself wasn't there to give it. And I opened it up, and there was no letter in it whatsoever. There was nothing about Dear Mike or how are you and I heard you got a new bicycle or anything like that, right? I opened up the envelope, and it seemed like there was nothing in it. And I turned it upside down, and the stub of a ticket fell out. And I didn't really understand what it was, so I take it to my mother, and I say, what's this? She said, this is you're the beneficiary of a $10,000 insurance policy that he took out at the airport, and this is your stub. You should hold on to it. this was an expression of my father's love, and it was to my father. This was an expression of his love. And now that I'm older, you know, when I was a kid, everything seemed more simple. You know how it is when your kid, things seem black and white or more simple to you. When I'm older now. And I understand how complex and difficult it can be to love somebody. And maybe you don't have this experience, but I think men, most of us do, how it can be so difficult and complex and how accepting love and giving love is maybe the hardest thing in the world to do. And more if you didn't get much of it or you got it in a bizarre, strange way when you were a kid. What comes in goes out that way. So instead of feeling happy or loved by seeing this insurance stub with just my father's signature on it and my name on it and the amount from some insurance company, it just made me angry and depressed. And I would rather have had my father there than to have him flying off all over the world and have $10,000 in case he died. And what I thought to myself was, he was always flying over someplace. I thought to myself he was flying overseas. I was in a rage and really disappointed. And I said, I hope he dies. I hope his plane crashes and he dies in the ocean. Yeah, that's what I hope. Although I didn't tell anybody that because, you know, you say things like that, you could have a magical effect, right? And when I was around 30 years old, in fact, his plane crashed in the ocean and he died. So, you know, put that in your psychological pipe and smoke it and have it smoke you. Anyhow, if my father died, it was a tremendous shock, you know, because he died suddenly. He wasn't sick or anything. He was only 57 years old, a big, strong guy. And so my sister and I took a trip over to Istanbul and to settle his affairs, to check and see, you know, what was going on. He had a huge apartment over there that the company he worked for, he was the vice president in charge of some huge construction company in their Istanbul office. And a part of what he got, part of his perk, was a huge, I suppose, who knows what it would be worth now, in a fairly new building in Istanbul, a gigantic apartment. It was like seven rooms, you know, three bedrooms. He didn't really need to live by himself. But it was this huge apartment, and it overlooked the Bosphorus. It was an absolutely beautiful apartment, you know, polished, you know, inlaid wooden floors, and just a gorgeous apartment. So my sister and I went over there and, you know, to take care of things. And, you know, there was this feeling inside of, you know, we're always chasing my father. We're always trying to figure out where he was on it, where on earth he was, when he would be back, if he would be back. So it was almost as if my father was sort of going, and then finally he was gone. It seemed like an inevitable thing that he would die this way when I thought about it. Inevitable, you know, and he was always taking chances. He drove too fast. He would fly on airplanes that were rickety and strange. He would take trips into territory that was dangerous. He would do all kinds of things like this. And I figured it was inevitable. So it was a shock to find out that he had died because I thought he was almost sort of immortal because he always survived a lot of dangerous things. And he always came back from these long, exotic trips. But then when he was gone, it seemed like, yeah, well, that's the final period to the sentence that was my father, right? But so we went over there and we divided up various chores. And his apartment was full. My father was not a great lover of art and beauty. It wasn't really in him to do that. I mean, he appreciated, you know, movies and science. He liked science fiction books, and he liked to watch sports and stuff on TV, and liked to go to basketball games. That was his favorite sport, and sometimes a baseball game. But when it came to, literature or art or sculpture or any kind of art object, he didn't really care much. But his apartment in Istanbul was filled with absolutely beautiful, really expensive Persian, what are called Persian rugs, Oriental carpets and rugs, some from Turkey, some from Persia, some made out of silk, some huge ones, a couple of small ones, some that were mounted on the wall. And there were all kinds of very fancy and very beautiful ceramics and sculptures that he bought there. These were he bought for investment purposes. He bought this for investment purposes. And so my sister went over there, and I was never interested in this kind of stuff. First of all, I have no foresight. I didn't think, oh, well, we can sell this and we'll have money, because my sister and I, you know, we both had jobs and we worked. But I never really thought much about money, which is why in my old age here, I have no money. But my sister, you know, had more foresight than I did. She knew that if we could sell these things. So there developed between the two of us, my sister and I, a kind of competitiveness, which probably existed anyhow in advance. My father was always somewhat closer to my sister. You know, sometimes a parent will be more like a certain kid, one kid than the other, or be closer to one kid than the other, or sometimes even seem to love one kid more than the other. In my father's case, my sister was more like my father, and my father was more like my sister. My father just didn't get me at all, and I didn't really get my father. For me, it was my mother, and that that was unfortunate, but I was far more like my mother and much closer to my mother than my father. And my sister was somehow they got along better. And I always felt a little jealous of the fact that they got along better. So there was this thing that was developing. It was unconscious. You know, we were splitting up the different chores that we had to do. Like, for instance, I went to the embassy and had to – the American embassy, because I had to fill out something called – I'll never forget the title of this. It was a form at the American embassy called Report of the Death of an American Citizen. Like a good book title, right? Report of the Death of an American Citizen. And so I filled this out, and it was all very grim, and I was very sad and still in shock. And my sister was too, although my sister has a much more practical streak. And she's able to sort of take care of business better than I am. You know, she doesn't – it's not like she's not emotional. I mean, she's filled with emotions like anybody else, maybe even more than most people I know. But she was able to attend to practical things. So she was, you know, making sure that everything got packed up. And she was – a couple of times she was saying, well, this is worth, you know, probably – she was finding out from maybe people who were art dealers or dealers in Oriental carpets how much this was worth, how much that was worth. I actually was more interested in looking for objects that belonged to him. Like, he was a pipe smoker from time to time. So I was looking around, found an old pipe of his and an old pipe, a leather pipe holder, you know, for when the pipe was out. So it didn't burn up, you know, something that you could carry the pipe in, and a tobacco pouch. I found a couple of, you know, like personal items like that. And one of them was a Swiss Army knife, which was so typical of my father to have a Swiss Army knife. And it wasn't an affectation with my father. Being an engineer and being an inveterate tinkerer and knowing how to, you know, build things and how to use all kinds of tools. Yeah, the Swiss Army knife was in good shape, but it was well used. I mean, there wasn't anything, and this was a big, you know, super duper version of a Swiss Army knife, and a real Swiss Army knife, not a knockoff. And it had everything on it: screwdriver, you know, pliers, a coffee maker, you know, a rocket grenade launcher. Everything was on this Swiss Army knife. And my father had obviously used it. And to have that would be like to have my father. To have the tobacco pouch. To have the pipe would be like my father. So these are the things I went for. And my sister was, you know, assessing the value of the rugs and things like that. Now, I'm not casting any aspersions on my sister. She loved my father as much more. I don't know. You know, who can measure these things? But she loved my father dearly and tremendously. And she was in shock over all this, too. But she, I think, felt, because she's just different than I am, that the money... she wanted the money. She wanted to use the money, but I never thought, and I could have used the money too, but I didn't think about the money. It's just something I never thought about, money and material objects that much. And I wish I had in my life. I would have been better off in my elderly years here, in my golden years. So we split these kinds of things up, and she wasn't as interested in these things, I thought, anyhow. I thought she wasn't as interested in them. But I had a very strange reaction when I was over in Istanbul. I was in such grief. But for me, love was so complex between me and my father. It went with hatred. Love and hatred went together. And I couldn't divide them. I couldn't simplify them. It was easier, I think, for my sister because she just, I can't say that she didn't, that she wasn't angry. My father wasn't around. But she had a much more direct and a much more, I think, simple, you know, easier love for my father than I did, because I never really did understand him, and he never understood me, and I could never relate to him. But I was always chasing after him and trying to get him to love me, and he just didn't seem to want to do it. So what happened was I found a whole bunch, and another thing we found in his apartment, I found. And she didn't care too much about it, was because it really wasn't worth much, was like practically a bushel full of Turkish money. And at that time, Turkish money, I mean, it was like one of these things you read about inflation in Germany. They were like, you could have 100,000 Turkish, I think it was called lira for some reason, L-I-R-A, like the Italian lira. But, you know, 100,000 of them was worth like $100 or, you know, $200, something like that. So... And long story short, I roamed around Istanbul and I took this money and I was drunk a lot. I was drinking a lot. We stayed in a hotel. The two of us stayed in a hotel, the Hilton in small rooms at the Hilton Hotel in Istanbul. And one night I took all this money and went down to the casino. There was a casino at the hotel and was drinking too much, and I gambled every last cent of it away. At one point, I was winning a lot of money. I had a couple of hundred thousand Turkish lira, which was, I don't know, like I said, $500 or something like that. And I just kept gambling till it went all, till it was all gone. And then we went to the bazaar. It's inevitable. You go to the bazaar in Turkey, the Grand Bazaar in Istanbul, rather, one of the most astounding places in the world. People from all over the place, Turks, they'll buy and sell anything. They'll buy and sell your head if you don't hold on to it there. They'll offer you money for your feet if you don't, everybody's bargaining and everybody's making deals, and there's everything in the world for sale in that place. I'm sure a lot of it was illegal too, but absolutely beautiful things, practical things, glassware, cookery, homemade, copper pots and rugs, statues, marble, antiquities, a million things for sale in this gigantic covered bazaar. But I'm still feeling all sorts of torn and weird about my father. And at one point, I went into the bazaar and I was looking at his Swiss Army knife. I was in a trance, kind of like in a trance. I didn't really know how I was feeling or what I was doing. And I look at the Swiss Army knife immediately. Some Turkish guy comes over, and he says, how much for the Swiss Army knife? How much do you want for the Swiss Army knife? And without thinking, I said, $5, American. And he gave me the money, and I handed him the Swiss Army knife. And I can't explain why I did it and how I felt about it. I mean, this was my father, right? But I gave it away, just like I gambled all this money away. And I sold this for $5. And it was sort of like that's the ultimate insult. You know, take that for not being around. The hell with your objects and your money and everything else and your rugs. This is what I think of you, right? And I'm standing there for a little bit, and I turn around, and my sister was watching me. She saw me sell this Swiss Army knife. And she was outraged with me. How could I do a thing like that? How could I sell off something that was so much my father? Why would I do a thing like that? And it's hard to explain, because I was angry, because I was enraged, because he was gone, because he had lived a life where he wasn't around, and he gave me presents instead of or objects. I had to have his objects instead of him. I never had him, and now I was never going to have him. That was it. So the hell with the Swiss Army knife and the hell with everything else. Like I said, I still have one or two things that I held on to that he gave me or that other people gave me after he died that he wanted me to have. And I never understood my father. He did love me, my father. And certainly I loved him, but it was complex. And so, you see these famous lawsuits going on right now. The money and my father, there was a lot of money left, actually. He had he had stocks and bonds in his safe deposit box, and he had insurance, a lot of insurance money, because he died, and there was a lawsuit against the airline, Turkish Airlines, and there was insurance because he was on company business when he died. So there was a lot of money left over, which I took and used. One thing my father said before he went away to Turkey was that he had an idea that he would use some money he had to put a down payment on a brownstone in Brooklyn, where I lived in Park Slope in Brooklyn. And he and I would live in it together. And the first thing I did with the share of money I got from the lawsuits and from the insurance money when the estate was finally settled was a brownstone. I bought a brownstone. And to me, that brownstone was my father. When I was living in that brownstone, and I was, the landlord, and I owned that brownstone, I would sit on the steps. I felt like I was sitting in my father's lap. The brownstone, this old, warm brown stone, I touched it, and I felt like I was actually touching my father's arm. Or if I went down to the boiler room to check it out, and it was an old, solid building, I felt like I was in my father's, like Jonah and the whale. I felt like I was in my father's stomach. Or if I went over near the boiler, I felt like that was the beating heart of the building, like that was my father's heart. What became of that? That's another whole story. That's another whole story. Part of my complex relationship to him, this love and hatred, because of his complex relationship to me, was that I was self-destructive with the things that he left me. So the story of what happens to the brownstone is another story. But when people give presents instead of themselves, when they don't give their actual presence, when they don't give themselves in of themselves, when they're not there for you or with you, and when they substitute money for that, when they, you know, they pay for this and they pay for that, that's their expression of love. And sometimes that's the best people can do. And I understand that now that I'm older, right, that you give what you can give, whatever love you feel and whatever love, whatever way you can express it. Well, that's the way you express it. But this kind of money and objects being the symbol of love or of people, it's human nature. I mean, look at religion. Christ's blood and his body at the Last Supper, a.k.a. a Seder, you know, when he was with his disciples, he said, this is, you know, this is my blood. This is my body. And in Christianity, there is, you know, there's all this stuff about, you know, all that. There's a personification of Christ. So holy relics were always a big thing, always a big thing. In fact, it was a corrupt industry, a huge corrupt industry throughout the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages, selling, you know, holy relics, you know, the knuckle bone of Saint somebody or other, or the skull of somebody, or the shroud of Turin, you know, whatever object. We don't have Christ with us. You know, he said, the poor you will always have with us, me you only have for a short while. So when he was gone, and a piece of the true cross, if every piece of the true cross that Christ was crucified on was gathered together and put in one place, it would be a chunk of wood the size of Montana, right? And so all these symbols, it seems like it's human nature that people, I myself, I never really went in for that, but one time I did. I was such a big fan of Henry Miller's once, when I had some money, that I bought several inscribed books by Henry Miller that had his signature on it. And for me, it was like I had part of Henry Miller. You know, he took the ink and he wrote in that book, and I felt like Henry Miller's presence was with me. You know, if you had, you know, a piece of the true cross or the knuckle bone of a saint or whatever, or the leather strap on the sandal that Christ was wearing, you could feel maybe that Christ was with you. But in fact, it's just a piece of leather. It's just a piece of wood. The brown stone was just brown stone. When somebody's gone, they're gone. And if you didn't have the love, you didn't have the love in the first place, then you can't replace it with something else. You can't replace it with something else. And like I say, this doesn't go for everybody. This doesn't go for everybody. And I'm using my case as an extreme example. My father, have I stopped? Now, you see, Miss Picasso has been in therapy, it says here, for 15 years. This is on the front page of the New York Times, by the way. I say this in defense of the fact that I think this is what gives me an excuse to call it a universal thing, or else why put her story with all its bitterness and the use of objects and money to replace love that she never got from her grandfather? Why put it on the front page? I mean, obviously it has universal meaning, and a lot of people feel it. But as I said before, if you're not from a family, and if you're lucky enough to come from a family where you had both parents with you most of the time or all the time, unless they took trips or they got sick and you didn't see them for a little while or something. But if they were almost always there, and they wrote you frequent letters, and when you went home, they were there. When you got home at the end of the day, your mother was there. At night, your father would get home from work. And this is, again, another generation, perhaps, that I'm talking about. Maybe now it's when your mother gets home from work and your father gets home from work and the nanny gets dismissed. So, you know, but at least they're there every day, right? But there's a little bit of a problem there, too, because there's kids in my neighborhood who are the children of very, very rich people who sometimes never see their parents very much at all. The nanny is there from like 7:30 in the morning or 8, taking them to school sometimes, even on the weekends, way until late at night sometimes. If you're talking about surgeons and international financiers who are always traveling, or people who work at banks, or lawyers, big shot lawyers, and their mother and their father, they don't see their parents that much. And the kids are often very neurotic. because that love is not there. So like I say, maybe you don't come from a family like that, and God bless you. If you come from a family where your parents loved you, they could have billions of dollars, and who cares, right? It doesn't mean that much to you. Yeah, the money's important. Yeah, it can help you. And if they mean the money to leave to you for the sake of love and to help you out, then you could appreciate that. But if the money was given to you in place of them, if they were never around, even if they really did love you, if they were never around and they were dedicated to a profession or traveling all over the world, or like Robin Williams or James Brown or Martin Luther King or something, if they were traveling all over the place on great missions or on performances or movie locations, or in Martin Luther King's case, you know, just traveling all over the country doing the extraordinary work he did, your kids probably don't see you that often. They don't really know you that well. And so the absence of a parent, sometimes if they leave a lot of money or objects or documents or whatever, and this is what Martin Luther King's kids are fighting over, his copies of speeches and the money that they're all worth. If all that stuff is available, then there'll sometimes be wars between siblings over this, or between, wives or stepmothers and children, these kinds of wars over, you know, over the money. And it's a sad thing because obviously the money cannot replace love. Money cannot replace love. But people quite often think it can, and they will fight over it. What they're fighting over is the love. They're fighting over the love. But in this case, Picasso's granddaughter is taking the money that she's getting, although the first painting she's selling is La Famille, the family. She's taking the money and she's giving it to good causes. So this is the best somebody in her position can do. She's taking the indifference, the insensitivity that she perceives and may have been real, and she's taken all the money that was left to her. And maybe this was an expression that the love was there that she didn't think was there from her grandfather, and she's giving it to good causes, and good for her. This is the best thing you can do with it.
Words can buy me love. But money can buy me love. I'll give you all I've got to give if you say you love me too. I may not have a lot to give, but what I got, I'll give to you. I don't care too much for money, but money can buy me love.
Property.
Sorry we are too peeled, mister.